Hello, everybody, and welcome to That Millennial Life. My name is Joe Cole, and this is my podcast where I talk to different millennials about their lives and how they are managing young adulthood. How's everybody doing? Thank you for listening. Today on the podcast, I talk to Evan Samlin. I met Evan in an improv class that we both took at UCB, which I think I've mentioned before. For people who don't know, UCB is short for Upright Citizens Brigade, which is an improv and sketch theater that was founded by Amy Poehler and Matt Walsh and Matt Besser and Ian Roberts. Some of those people are not universally known names, but I think I actually just probably coincidentally said their names in descending order of their individual fame. However, all improv legends and immensely talented. You know, everyone knows Amy Poehler, of course. Matt Walsh is in Veep and was just nominated for an Emmy, actually, this year and has had several supporting roles in comedy movies. Matt Besser has a fantastic improv podcast called Improv for Humans, which Ian Roberts is actually in a lot. And Ian actually, I think, was a writer on Key and Peele, and he co-wrote Get Hard. But anyway, I honestly just gave you all their credentials because I felt bad after making the comment about the fame and wanted to give each one their fair praise because, you know, although someone may not necessarily be in the forefront of popular culture, you know, that doesn't mean that people aren't working and also extremely talented, which is kind of what Mike Birbiglia's movie Don't Think Twice is about. You should go see that. It's in theaters now. It's fantastic. But anyway, a big reason, you know, those people are improv legends is because the theater that they founded now is and has been the premier improv theater in New York City, and if not the entire country, you know, for live improv and sketch performance, and also for training and education. Some of the best improvisers in the world perform there, and a lot of young comedy talent on television from recent years started at UCB. You know, like the lovely and hilarious women from Broad City, Alana Glazer and Abby Jacobson, Aubrey Plaza from Parks and Rec, Zach Woods from Silicon Valley, Bobby Moynihan and Kate McKinnon from SNL, who else? Nick Kroll, Aziz Ansari, Ben Schwartz, as well as several other very talented people. But anyway, I just graduated from a 301 level class at UCB, which Evan, who I talked to today, was in as well. And, you know, I feel like I say a lot that I enjoyed the conversation that I had with the guest, so I feel like just plainly saying that again another time doesn't do justice to how I felt about this conversation, because every conversation is unique. Although I do always enjoy the conversation because, you know, for the most part, because these conversations are really the only times in my life that I do sit down with someone and talk to them one-on-one for an hour. Especially sometimes with someone who I don't know that well. But this conversation had a uniquely positive effect on me because although the conceit of the show is that I talk to people who are close to me in age and who are in this weird limbo in between childhood and adulthood, and everyone's trying to start to get their shit together and grow up, and, you know, we're all going through generally similar things as me, Evan is someone who I identified with and related to more than normal because he graduated college the same year as me and has been doing kind of what I am doing, which is, you know, allowing himself to have some time to explore and pursue what he wants to do and what he feels, you know, creatively inclined to do. And also in that, you know, his creative inclinations and aspirations, you know, which for him more specifically revolve around comedy. He's also actively pursuing stand-up comedy, which we talk about right from the start, which he actually talks about when his next show will be. I forget when it is, but he says it at some point throughout the podcast, and I actually start recording while he's talking about it without him knowing what you'll hear. But, yeah, you know, like, what was I saying? Oh, his reasons for wanting to pursue it are more complicated and nuanced than just wanting to be a comedian, if that makes sense. You know, in this conversation, you'll hear what I mean by that, I think. And maybe you have some ideas about what I mean from the title of the episode. about kind of the importance of comedy to him. But, you know, in this conversation, he talks about how comedy was one of the things that, you know, helped him navigate through some of life's more complicated questions and helped him maybe, you know, alleviate the stress that comes with that. Which, you know, then kind of weirdly sparked a conversation about the importance the role art has in reflecting society back on itself. And I think I kind of related to that because I've always looked to artistic voices that I enjoyed to help me navigate through different things. And, you know, I just really enjoyed this conversation, like I say all the time. And then after, you know, we actually saw Sausage Party, which coincidentally meditated as a movie. It meditated on some of the theological themes and topics that we coincidentally were talking about. And I don't want to give anything away, but what we took away as the message was kind of a perfectly timed, you know, reaffirmation about the power of comedy and, you know, artistic expression, even though that sounds very pretentious and lofty about a movie about hot dogs that say dirty words. But anyway, enough blabbling. Blabbling? Blah, 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 blah. Let's get to my conversation with Evan Samlin.
Instead of five comics, he has seven comics this time.
I'm not really prepared at all.
Been writing?
Yeah, I write all the time, but I don't memorize that much, and I don't like doing the whole going out, like, performing thing, but I like it when it's done and people laugh.
You don't just like the doing it, you just like the laugh part? The laugh is what?
I like the writing. It's, like, very therapeutic for me.
That's your favorite part of it?
Are you interviewing me?
I gotcha.
Did you?
Bada bing bang boom. Welcome to the Joe and Evan show.
I think we're recording. Yeah, we are.
No, we're not.
Yeah, we are.
Oh, shit.
Why do you like writing the best?
For comedy, it's just like very therapeutic. I like thinking of like new ideas that could be funny. And it's just like something I can do that makes me feel productive in terms of comedy. But
you like having a purpose?
Yes. Yeah, I like going to bed and feeling like I did something.
Has there ever been a time in your life where like you consistently like did nothing?
Yeah, I think
after college, where you just sat around for most of the time.
Not really so much after college, because throughout college, like especially senior year on, I've wanted to be in the comedy industry.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been very dedicated. But I think in late middle school and high school,
mm-hmm.
there was like a lot of time I felt like there was no purpose to anything. And like
it was late middle school, you had that type of existential.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like a bad student for a while, and like I got in trouble a lot in school, which was
wait, so where did the like not thinking there's a point to anything start at that young of an age? Like how did that become realized?
I guess I don't know what age it hit, but it was like a lot of like new, you know, comics and material coming out that was very anti-organized religion.
Mm.
And I think there was like a lot of built up anger that like these things that I had been told were not true.
Mm.
Not necessarily religious things, even things such as like, don't. I don't know. I feel like we're getting very heavy. My phone isn't even turned off.
It's okay. It's quite all right. Well, if you don't want to do that, or if you don't want to talk about it, that's fine. But you brought it up. Was that a direct reason as to why you started pursuing comedy? Well, it seems kind of self-perpetuating if comedy were the things that brought upon those ideas to you, and then it's also a way of kind of disarming them. It was like kind of the origin of your thinking like that, and also kind of the continuing to like,
yeah,
try to deal with it.
I think you could say that. I think there was a lot of humor in school. I definitely, had an outlook in life for a while to just sort of do the least amount of work to get a B.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people can relate to that, and just trying to sort of push teachers' buttons without getting kicked out of class.
Yeah, finding the threshold.
Yeah, like slowly
where's the
eroding,
line?
Eroding that line day by day. But no, I think comedy for me came even earlier. There's this story when I was like 7 years old. My parents went away on vacation.
Make sure you stay up close to that.
Sorry about that. Okay. This is my first time podcasting with the great Joe Cole.
Not great yet, or ever maybe.
He is great. Before I tell this story, I think this is like awesome. What you do, it's very real, and it really. I listened to your first episode finally.
Oh, did
and
you?
It reminded me of Howard Stern, and in its realness and. I think it takes a lot of guts to sort of like put yourself out there.
Yeah, it's also kind of just disregarding the reality of the fact that I'm just putting everything I think out there, and I kind of just don't think about it.
Yeah,
because I assume that maybe it'll just dissipate in the corner of the internet somewhere, and it won't really.
Well, for the people who don't do it, I think it's pretty brave.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thanks, man. Appreciate that.
Anyway, how I became. Like very.
That was me waiting to the last second to accept your compliment. I really didn't want to, but
no, I see that. me and Joe became friends at UCB.
Yeah, improv
theater, and I think the third class, I thought Joe was like very funny, a good straight man, in improv, and I went up to him and I said, "Dude, I think you're really funny." And, you know, I don't say that to a lot of people, even though many people do.
Yeah,
and Joe, like, couldn't take the compliment at all. I just brushed it off, like, to the next step.
Started talking about something else.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I just realized now that I did that. Well, thank you. But anyway, that story about comedy, something, when you were a kid, you said? What were you saying?
Yeah, so my grandma was taking care of us. My grandma Arlene, rest in peace.
What's your grandma's name?
Arlene.
Wow, my grandma's name was Darlene.
Darlene.
Also rest in peace. Wow.
Mm. Yeah, so
how you doing on the grandparent front? Is that my phone?
Yes, that is your phone. Both our phones are going off.
So popular.
So I'll just tell my story while Joe's over there. All my parents are grandparents are
same.
Passed away.
Wow.
Which only my grandmothers were alive for sort of my memory aspect. And so I was definitely close with both of them. Mm. And my grandma Arlene stayed to watch us. And I have an older brother. Who was 9 at the time, I was 7. And then I have a younger brother who was 2 at the time.
Hmm.
So I'm the middle of 3 boys. And my younger brother could not stop crying because my mom left.
Bitch.
Yeah. He's a little bitch, Jason. No, he's a good kid. And he couldn't stop crying and crying. And for well over an hour, and there was nothing we could do.
Yeah.
And my grandmother, like, didn't know what to do. And somehow, I decided to go to my mother's bathroom and put on her makeup and her lipstick, and I put on hair extensions and, like, a hair clip.
Wow, this is very dedicated to the bit very early
and
on.
And I came out, and I said...
You came out?
I went to my brother Jason, and I said, I'm your mommy.
Yeah.
And he started laughing.
No
way. Laughing. And he stopped crying. And it was like, my grandmother used to tell that story all the time.
Mm.
And it just like made me so proud that I like deflected like sort of this bad feeling and like made him laugh. Also, I want to point out that I was like transgender well before it was cool.
You're a pioneer.
Yeah.
You're
which
a trailblazer.
Isn't true. I'm not actually transgender. But in the story, it's I did funny wear how some it's such a
young
clothes.
Yeah, it's fun. It's funny how at such a young age you can realize. I guess it's a very a primal, instinctual thing of just alleviating like a negative vibe, which is like a big thing of people who are into comedy. Is just the it's more than just liking the laugh. It's kind of just disarming everything. It's kind of like making everything okay for a second.
Yeah,
I think of I've heard people say with comedy is that like when you're making people laugh, you know that someone at least you don't know that they like you, but at least you know that they don't hate you at that moment. Like that everything's good, and I think that has a big part of like what happened there or why it had such an impact on you.
Did you have, because we didn't go to the same high school
no.
to grow up together, did you have...
Evan's from Montville, which is like a town 10 minutes away from me, but I didn't meet him until we took an improv class in New York. But that's just a big coincidence. But anyway, what were you saying?
Did you have like a friend growing up who was like so funny?
No.
Like you just wanted to be around him?
My most recent episode was with Kev McMichael and... I told him that I said something weird to him where I was like, I don't think you realize how important you were to me, because he was like my first friend that I like did funny bits with. Whereas like growing up as like in elementary school and like middle school, I was more friends with athletes and kids people who were funny, but like no one who had like creative tendencies or like comedic tendencies. I was always looked at as like kind of the chubby, funny kid. Until I got a little more serious and
later. I can relate to that. Yeah. I was heavier growing up and was always a class clown. But I had this friend, Keenan,
mm-hmm.
Who was not working in like the creative mm-hmm. field at all.
Mm-hmm.
And we weren't even like that close of friends.
Mm-hmm.
But I just always remembered him like everything he said was funny.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always wanted to like be around him because the shit he would pull would like make me smile, would make me happier. And like in high school, we had a girls' basketball team that didn't mm-hmm. win a game for 3 straight years.
Wow.
And so Keenan had this idea, or maybe I did, I don't know, that we would become the super fans of the girls' basketball team in senior year. So me and Keenan would go to every game, or like 6 games in all honesty, and like the only people in attendance would be like the parents of the girls.
Mm-hmm.
And then Keenan... when they would get to like the foul line, the girls on the other team would be shooting like a free throw.
Mm-hmm.
Keenan would take out his cell phone like he was getting a call, and then he'd scream at the top of his lungs, like, "Mom, I don't need new underwear."
And it's quiet in the court
so
because
quiet.
No one's there.
No one's there, and he's just like screaming, and then they'd get to the free throw line again, and he'd be like, "Mom, stop calling me!" And it was the funniest shit.
Yeah, man, funny friends are important.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. I mean, even having a friend who, like, maybe isn't even necessarily funny, but, like, laughs at... you can tell, like, a friend is funny by, like, him laughing at things that you think are funny. Like, you laugh at the same things. But, yeah my friends now, like Mustafa Elgar and Kyle Buttry, who've been on this show, the most I ever laugh is with them when there's, like... It's like the in the movie Don't Think Twice, which is they're all, like, best friends, and they can go to a place of, like, an inside baseball-type humor between themselves that, to them, is funnier than anything because, like, of what their relationships are. Because, like, the most I've ever laughed is with those people and with friends. Like,
yeah, well,
the funniest I've ever been is with those people.
I think the biggest hurdle in comedy is to get someone to relate to your premise.
Yeah.
So I think jokes between friends, I always laugh more at a joke
because there's an understanding.
Stand-up, because we experience something together.
There's a shorthand.
I think the hardest part of stand-up is to get that picture into the audience's mind before you pull it all.
That's why Chris Rock says the premise like 3 times.
Yeah.
So when did it like, so you're a class clown? Were you a class clown?
I was. I think I joke so much that like a lot of people, I have a very dry sense of humor a lot of times. So like a lot of my friends didn't always know when I was joking, when I was being serious.
Mm.
But usually... if you were smart, you could tell because the jokes were so absurd that no one could be serious, and the serious stuff made sense.
Yeah.
So, if I'm ever on the line, I usually say I'm kidding.
Right, right. If there's any, like kind of, if it's up in the air at all, of whether or not you're being serious or not. You gotta.
Yeah.
But yeah. So the thing I wanted to ask was, the middle child thing. Because you get caught in the rush of everything. I've heard that as like a middle child, like he's the least attention to. Is that why maybe you were funny, because you had to like maybe put on more of a bit of a show to get some attention, or were you well accounted for?
You know, I've never thought of that, but yeah, that definitely sounds right.
Yeah.
So my older brother's 2 years older. We are roommates together in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
So we were sort of raised more similarly than my younger brother. So I did sort of feel like my older brother got things first, although I got them sometimes at the same time.
Right.
And then my little brother, when he was raised, we had a little more money, and my parents had been a little more relaxed from having two boys and like all the shenanigans we pulled.
Mm-hmm.
So they were a little easier on him. So I think out of the three brothers, I'm definitely, like, when I go home, I'm the most, I try to be funny. I try to make things lively.
Do you command the room?
I think I do in my family sometimes.
Yeah.
My dad is also very funny guy.
What does he do?
He is a partner at a law firm.
Oh, wow.
So
a lot of stand-up comedians and like comedians, improv comedians, like were like had law as like law. Their
yeah, Dimitri Martin
talks
about it big time. And my older brother just graduated from law school and now has a great job in the city in law. So it definitely, I have uncles who are lawyers, aunts who are lawyers. So
who's
there's
the,
definitely a law background to my life.
The kid on What I Did for Love, who's the head writer for the Daily Show now. Daily Show. I forget his name. He's Indian or something. So he has
an interesting name.
He's not an American
name.
Does
he have a law degree?
He started in law. I think he does, but he started in law.
Yeah.
I saw that on his like bio. He's the head writer of the Daily Show now, and he's on an improv team at UCB. But yeah, there's a big, I guess it's just the talking, wanting to be in front of people.
Yeah, the logic, the breaking down.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I think, like I studied philosophy in college, and I think that is similar to comedy.
Where'd you go to college?
In certain ways. I went to the College of New Jersey.
TCNJ.
TCNJ, and played football there for a year. Yeah, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
It's like good in New Jersey.
Yeah.
Like you've heard of it, you know, it's a good school. But
yeah,
like when I got pulled over, I wasn't driving, luckily.
Yeah.
I went down to New Orleans with some fraternity brothers, and they asked us where we went to school. Yeah.
What fraternity?
Phi Kappa Tau. And they asked us where we went to school, and we said the College of New Jersey.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, a community college? And this girl who was in the car with us just freaked out. Like, it's a good school.
No! So, like, better than that.
I don't really, like, for me, my older brother went to the College of New Jersey.
Mm.
So for me to...
Where'd he go to law school?
He went to GW.
Wow.
So
wow.
I always thought he was, like, the smart one.
Mm.
So for me to go to the College of New Jersey
big
is
ups.
Like a big a big goal in my life.
Yeah. Just hit my table. So when you were in high school, what were you hoping college to be? What was the expectations for that? What was your major?
I was a philosophy major.
Oh, right. So what was the thing you were saying that about philosophy that you learned, or what were you saying before I asked you where you went to school?
I can just talk about it
because
we got...
Yeah.
I find this interview style very interesting for
what?
Those of you who haven't been interviewed by Joe.
Because
we
just
sat in his room.
It's getting hot in here without the fucking air conditioning.
It is a little hot.
Maybe I should put the fan on.
And
if it gets hotter, I'll put the fan on.
And me and Joe were just talking. And then at some point I was like, are you recording? And he just was.
You know, I'm just going. So, and we're 18 minutes in.
We are 18 minutes in.
We're like a third of the way done.
And wow, that is... this
a
is
little,
much easier the way he does it.
Than what? Than you would think?
Than I would think. I thought it was going to be like peppered, like, where were you on the night of, you know...
Well, I feel like it's hard because, like, there is definitely, like, the first, like, 7 or 8 minutes, it was definitely a good flow, and then there was a lull. Like, there was a stop where I was like, like a noticeable stop where I had to be like, okay, where are we going now? And where I think the audience recognizes, okay, I have to shift gears, but I think I'm good at just keeping it going.
I think you're, yeah, I think you have great talent, and I see just such a beautiful soul in Joe Cole.
Oh no.
Rhymes, and he is
beautiful soul in Joe Cole.
He's wearing a Red Hawks t-shirt.
That's my brother. He went to MSU. Yeah. My gray sweatpants and my gray hair. I have gray hair. My grandpa had gray hair for his high school picture. I'm fucking doomed. Like, noticeable gray hair.
I think that's not that big of a problem in today's world.
Yeah, right?
World because silver hair George dye Clooney. Is, like, very
yeah,
popular.
That's true.
You also have, like, a little, like, cocky on your eyelash.
What's a cocky?
It's like
a eye booger?
Little, yeah, a little eye booger.
You're going to have to tell that to them, Evan.
Sputum.
Some type of mucus accumulation. But, yeah, so this is the one thing you said you had that prepared that you want to talk about. What was that?
Yeah, so something that's, just to give you a little background, religion has had a big influence on my life.
Mm.
Doubts and, you know, everything about
questioning
religion,
and
questioning,
researching,
insecurities. Mm. And when I was born into a Jewish family. And
circumcised?
I was, yes. I had the full purple helmet. And yeah, everything looks good down there.
Yeah, it works.
It works. Sometimes.
On a good day.
And and I went to a school in Randolph, New Jersey, where I was born, called the Hebrew Academy.
Wow, how old were you then?
I went there until I was 7 years old.
Mm.
And that school
so it's like
was
first and
super private,
grade.
And there's not that many Jews in the world who
so
go to
Jews.
Private school, especially. Yeah. So my grade was about 10 people max.
Wow.
The entire grade.
Wow.
And like, I'm pretty sure there was one grade, like third grade, that had maybe like three people. So like they had to like go
very
with the
focused.
Fourth graders. Yeah. It kind of sucked.
Is it like I mean, I've heard you associate your mom's Jewishness, for lack of better words, with overprotection and with accountability. Do you think that you being in that school where there's like a little more focus and it's less people for the teachers to worry about has something to do with that? Is it all come together where like maybe you were held more accounted for?
I think as a kid, I was very driven. I was a very good student. Mm. I was very faithful. And
where did that come from?
I think it came from my upbringing, from just being young and naive and, you know, believing what you're spoon-fed.
But it wasn't self-generated? Were you told by parents and teachers to do that, or did you just start, like, trying and caring? Not even sure?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think I just was very, I loved reading as a kid, so school kind of came naturally for me young.
Mm-hmm. So you go to the school, first and second grade?
So I went to school through first grade, and then I moved to Texas.
What?
My dad got a job at a place called EMC, which was a branch of Bear Stearns, which is, I believe, no longer a company. It was one of the companies that crashed in the financial crisis.
Oh, wow.
But luckily, he wasn't there when that happened.
Huh.
And so we moved to Texas, and I went to an elementary school that was probably bigger than Pequannock High School.
Right. Like it Pequannock High School is like 800 people.
All right. So it was probably like four times bigger. It was like a huge elementary school. And I was the only Jewish kid in the entire elementary school.
Wow.
And so that was like a weird aspect, but like it made me unique.
So
I
you go
really
from
care.
This traditional Jewish kind of Orthodox, even? Was it like...
It wasn't Orthodox, but it was like pretty... Half the day in class was we learned Hebrew, and half the day was English.
Wow. To an environment where there was no other people like that.
There were no Jews. We had one synagogue in our county, and our county was probably bigger than New Jersey. So there were not many Jews where I lived in Texas. And
what came of that?
And what came of that is I had a best friend in third grade, and I slept over at his house.
Hmm.
And the next day at school, he said that he was no longer allowed to speak to me.
Mm-hmm.
Which I don't really talk about this much, but he wasn't like allowed to speak to me because I was going to go to hell and like I was impure. And so then there was like a big group of kids at my elementary school.
Sorry, I'm laughing.
Yeah,
it's ridiculous. It's so funny. It's so ridiculous. Was he Catholic?
I don't know, to tell you the truth, because I don't, until I was older, I never understood the differences. And then there was a huge group of kids in my elementary school who would make crosses with their fingers when I went near them shun me away.
What?
Yeah. So, and I think looking back, that sort of had like a big influence because I started to doubt a lot of things. And when we moved back to New Jersey, to Montville, in sixth grade, I became an atheist.
You were in Texas till sixth grade?
Through fifth grade, and then came back for sixth grade.
So through third and fourth and fifth grade?
Second, third, fourth, and fifth.
What was the evolution of that type of thing happening to you? Did it die down eventually, or was it a constant? As kids get older, couldn't have been a constant, like, kids shunning you.
It was sort of like a thing that happened for like a month.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had a lot of friends in Texas who like didn't care. So like, I always like, my parents were like, they're stupid. Like, don't listen to them. And that's sort of what I thought. I thought it was all like, you know, I used to say things like, you know, Jesus was a Jew, like stupid things like, why do you think this? But I had no idea
the Jews anything about
anything about religion at the time. So,
well, you say you have doubts. Was it just like the kind of it from being the first time where there was like some other type of or some other way of thinking was like presented to you? Was it just like, oh, these people think this and I think this, like we can't both be right? Was it, and then was it like a realization of like, probably none of us are right. This is probably just all horseshit.
I think it was a lot of that. I think like later on into high school, I started to just have insecurities and think why, like people started dying who I knew. And, you know, why does this happen?
Like
and,
who?
And, well, both my grandmas passed away.
That young?
That was like the first year of college.
Oh, wow.
But
so was there like any specific researching or like kind of more of a focus on like trying to find more things out about this, or was it just like a feeling of like, I think this is all fucked, or was it?
Yeah, I think what happened was I thought this was all just fucked. I became an atheist. I was like, fuck religion. Like, there's too many wars over religion.
I guess I'm trying to get to why it had such an impact on you.
And like, there are a lot of like, at the time, like, I listened to a lot of George Carlin and, like, a lot of people, and there were a lot of atheist sort of influences. Mm. And then I went to college.
Right.
And I didn't know what I wanted to study. And so I thought I wanted to do something like what you did. You were, like, a film major. So I took, like, Comm 101, and I took all these different electives, and I took Philosophy 101. And Philosophy 101, I loved it. Mm-hmm. And I became obsessed with sort of these things called like theistic proofs of like God's existence or God's non-existence, basically like these great minds who like tried to break it down into just like simple words, why God does or doesn't exist. And so for most of college, I studied philosophy of religion. I took electives in it. I wrote my independent study on it. I wrote my senior thesis on it. So this is sort of, and I think it's something that like a lot of kids our age sort of maybe go through or think about, like they doubt religion, but then they also doubt atheism and they don't know like where they stand. Like I still don't know what I think.
Mm.
So these were sort of like the tenets of like where I am now that I wanted to share with you. That was all just background.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what are they?
So the first thing is this thing that René Descartes is famous for, his magnum opus, which is called in Latin the cogito ergo sum, which means I think, therefore I am.
Yep.
And that is like my first tenet of philosophy. And what that means for people who don't study philosophy is that Descartes doubted things. He doubted, you know, things his parents taught. He doubted that Joe was wearing an MSU t-shirt. He doubted even his senses, things that we take for granted.
Things that were very easily perceptible to him, things that he that were maybe ubiquitously thought of as truth, he even doubted.
Yes.
Like, is that tree even right
simple
there?
Simple truths like that tree.
Yeah.
And he went down and doubted everything and everything, and he found the one thing he couldn't doubt is that he existed.
Mm-hmm.
Because in order for him to doubt, there must have been someone or something, even if it wasn't him as a person, doing the doubting.
Mm-hmm.
So he left with this idea that something exists, mostly me.
So why does that?
So that is like the first tenet. Like I sort of, in philosophy, you sort of like build things up. So my first tenet is sort of that we know something exists.
Right.
We can't doubt it. And like, that's where I love to start.
So that's kind of like the fundamental, like the foundation of like your understanding of everything is like, I'm here.
Yeah, there is something.
Yeah.
That's what I boil it down to.
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
definitely, we're podcasting, there yeah. is something. So then my next thing is like, it's sort of like a thought exercise, which is to try and imagine nothing. And I want you to tell me sort of if
I just
you
thought of
see
an elephant.
Anything. That is more than nothing. It definitely is. So when people are told this, they sometimes imagine elephants, but they usually imagine like blackness in their mind or like blank white, or they imagine like a blank piece of paper. But philosophical nothing is less than that.
Right.
Like, it is absolutely nothing. So if you imagine, like, a blank space, like, that still has, like, the laws of physics, how they are today, like, gravity, it still has, like, space. Mm-hmm. Nothing is, like, nothing. It's the absence of something.
Mm.
And so there's this second big tenet that, like...
So kind of for there to be nothing, there had to be something, kind of.
That's exactly, almost that,
yeah.
Which is... The next Latin phrase, I'm throwing a lot of bullshit Latin at you guys, which is called ex nihilo nihilo fit, which means from nothing, nothing comes.
Mm.
So I believe that if you look at what was the first thing, it had to have been something. There wasn't nothing, and then something like shot out of it.
Right.
And so some like physicists might say, well, sometimes you can observe in the universe like maybe a particle like comes in and out of existence.
Mm.
But it had, like, something to come into existence of.
Right.
Which was already something.
Right,
there
right.
There couldn't have just been nothing that particle came into. There
right.
must have been blank space. And this is what's called the first cause argument. Did it come from what or the other?
Is so that, like, the chicken or the egg type thing, kind of?
Yeah, where did... when it boils it down, I don't want to go too in-depth
no,
with all
fine,
this
it's fine.
Philosophical shit, but...
Dude, that's where, what this is for.
Where did it all come from is called the first cause argument.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of people think that's God.
Mm.
And so this is something I sort of came up with from those two very strong philosophical tenets that I call the minimum requirement, which is that at minimum, there must have been something that always existed that could put the wheels in motion.
And that's God.
For things to be the way they are now. Now, some people say that's God. Even atheists believe that
yep.
because they believe there was matter before the Big Bang and before that there were strings. They even if you don't believe in God, they don't know what the first cause was, but they sort of believe that there always was something because or else there wouldn't be something now.
I have a friend who's Mustafa Elagar, who's been on this podcast, who's in deep of a philosophize this podcast. And I'm going to butcher what he said to me, but... Pretty much, it very much parallels with that, which is that there is something that causes everything to happen and has caused everything to happen. Like, there is, even though it's very individualistic, like, I'm the reason why that cup just fell because I hit it, like, the reason why that joke was told because you wrote it, there is something that... caused everything to happen, and that's God. Even though it's not the God that is the kind of universal understanding of God, of he controls everything that happens, like my grandma dying, he made everything. No, because I think that's evolution. But just the fact that things are happening, that's God kind of in a way.
Yeah, everything has a cause and effect,
right,
to it.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go back to the first thing, if something didn't come from nothing, if that wasn't the first cause, then something was definitely eternal. And I think what you just said and what a lot of the population says is that's God.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I went further into this, there's arguments that aren't just, you know, straight proofs for God. They're sort of like they appeal to the senses. And I think they're great arguments on both sides of the door, which is one of them's called the teleological argument, which is the argument from design, which means that the world appears to be designed. Mm. Like the way the planets rotate around each other, the way
looks like someone made it from a kit.
it looks like that it wasn't just random chance. Like it could be.
Yeah.
There's a great argument that, say, a tornado picked up all these car parts and then created a car.
Mm.
You would look at that car and say, someone created that.
Right.
But it was just random chance.
Right.
But although that is possible,
mm-hmm.
I think this is a great argument that you can say that the world was around for forever, which I don't know what that means because time is relative and like years don't really mean anything before the Earth and sun were created.
Right, right.
What does a year even mean if nothing's rotating the sun?
Right.
But it seems that the Earth or that the world was designed.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a great argument for God.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also great arguments against God.
Mm.
One of them being the problem of evil, which is that there's evil in the world, and if there was this perfectly great, good God, why would he allow evil to be in the world? And a lot of people say it's because of freedom of choice, which is a good thing, but that doesn't account for things like tornadoes, as I said before, natural evil.
Right.
And so then I hate this rhetoric that that religious people say where everything is good, we thank God, and then when bad things happen,
blame someone else.
It's because of like God works in mysterious ways.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that I'm not very fond of that. Mm. So there are bad things in the world, and that brings up another argument against God, which is called the best of all possible world, which is if we had a perfectly good God, he would create the best of all possible worlds for us to live in. And
what is that?
This doesn't seem to be the best.
Where does the idea that if there was a God, he would make everything perfect come from?
It comes from the idea that goodness is better than badness and suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone was all good, they wouldn't want people to suffer. And some people interpret that other ways. But I think it's also an interesting argument because I want to hear your take. Do you think, like, if you had the power, would you make the world exactly as it is? Because they say that God would have to make the world this way because what God does is like law. But to me, there's definitely things that could be better.
Mm-hmm.
So there's great arguments on both sides. And I think that's a problem that a lot of millennials run into, which is that they grow up Christian and they turn against organized religion, but yet they don't feel atheist either. They feel something in their gut. They mm-hmm. feel spiritual. And so my belief, and this is just totally my belief. There's no fact. If you want to believe it, you
belief
can.
Means
if you don't,
that
you know, is that how we're here because it looks designed, but because it doesn't look designed the greatest, is that God or the creator is eternal yet flawed.
Mm.
And so I don't believe in a
He's
perfectly
a mirror
good
of us,
God.
Maybe.
So exactly. They say like humans were created in God's image.
Mm.
I think that's truer than most of us understand. Like, I think of God as like a Marvel superhero instead of a DC United superhero.
Why? What is that? What is that?
Because, like, in DC United, like, Superman is, like, perfect.
He's the example of what we should strive to be.
Of what we should do. But Marvel tried something different, which was to make all their superheroes flawed and human. And, like, so some of them have lust or, like, you know, different qualities. So I think of... So that's sort of
been
a huge tenet of my life is that I have this very open and honest relationship where I talk out loud and I tell, you know, whoever's listening when I'm mad and things that I think could be better. But then I also thank for good things because I don't enjoy the idea that we should only thank the good things and then just like forget about everything else because life isn't perfect. It's very, we go through very insecure. We don't know, like, are we, what happens after death? None of us know. Does God exist? Does he not exist? No matter what we feel, none of us can truly know unless God, like, if he wanted, he could pick us all up and, you know, we could all be floating one day and he could say, I'm your God, be good, and I'll take care of you. And then I think it'd be easy. Everyone would be good. But we weren't afforded that luxury. So I just, it's sort of been this outlook on my life that life is very absurd. It's very absurd. There's a lot of problems in life that we don't want to talk about. And you have to, like, look at life and sort of laugh at the absurdity that we didn't ask to be born. We don't want to die. We didn't ask for any of this, but we're here and we don't know why. So I think if you don't sort of laugh through it and enjoy, then it's kind of like the joke is on you.
So a lot of that everything you just said made me think of a lot of things, but I guess the first thing I want to say is you just kind of offered a way in which you react to some of the negative and absurd things in life by trying to realize it for what it is, point out its absurdity and laugh at it, which is what the mission of comedy should be, is disarm and educate and, like, understand.
Yes.
And disarm it for what it is. How do you see society, how do you see that they collectively respond to something that's negative in a way that's different from you that you would like to change?
Well, I think what's different, at least from my aspect, is I call out God on his bullshit.
Right.
And I think for a believer in God, that is almost like hearsay, like blasphemy. And then for an atheist, I think there's a lot of atheists who, like, feel some things in their gut sometimes and feel like there might be something more to this, but all they have is Christianity or Judaism and Islam. And if you believe in that, I think that's great. But if you don't,
you can make your own.
There's other things out there than religions that were based 2000 years ago.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying is that people just feel like they have to do one of the three main ones, and it's just an organized religion where it's much more convoluted. Spirituality is much more convoluted than what that is.
Yeah, so it's like that bullshit, like, yoga person who's like, I'm not religious, I'm spiritual.
Right.
Yeah, that's sort of what I am, but more than that, I have a backbone, and that's sort of what I shared of why I am that way.
So you left comedy. There was a really weird, an interesting kind of parallel between the two things.
That's just something that
just coincidentally happened.
I, like,
maybe
I, you know, a lot of people use theistic proofs to prove Christianity, although all it does is prove God, or so they say, prove God. It doesn't prove Christianity. So maybe I use sort of my idea to my outlook on life has been to, like, laugh at it a lot more than the normal person. So maybe I sort of skewed my results to something that fits my personal philosophy.
Yeah, I've heard Judd Apatow say that he loves comedy and he loves comedians because he loved, when he was a kid, he loved how comedians could just say,
oh, this is just all bullshit.
Like, it is. It's all bullshit.
And he loved that he could exist in a world where comedians could do that, and he doesn't think he'd be able to survive without it. Like, that's how important it is to him, that they could just maybe be the... That's why I'm on this podcast, I've kind of spoken out about... And I'm a liberal person, but I've spoken out about, like, kind of... what's the thing? Like, a public political correctness and its effect on comedy and its effect on kind of artistic expression, and about how I don't think that art should be... I think I said this to you yesterday.
You did say this to
me. I don't think art should be judged, because I don't think... I think people should realize that it is an expression of 100% truth and reality. Whatever art is, it's an expression. It's an expression of someone's perception of what reality is, which inherently means that you can't claim the creator of whatever the thing is as like what they believe, because it's just what they perceive. It's not mm-hmm. like truth. Technically,
it's not truth, and we're always growing. Like I told you, there was a point in my life I was religious. A point in my life I was atheist. Mm-hmm. Like. Who knows? You could interview me 5 years from now, and I could tell you that what I said now was bullshit.
Right, yeah.
So
I listened back to some of my early episodes, and I'm like, oof.
So I think that is a problem that comedians or any artistic person runs into, is that you release content, and then you're judged by that for the rest of your life.
Right. And I'm just afraid that, like, this is kind of like not necessarily what you're talking about, but it's a good transition. But I think that it ties in with it, because it's in the same realm of like everyone having these different beliefs and ideas, and it getting in the way of us kind of getting in the way of unity, kind of getting in the way of everyone seeing eye to eye, for everyone kind of having a realized idea of like what everything is and what this all is. And I think artists and like comedians are the people who should have the liberty to kind of attempt to paint a mirror and show it to us of what everything is, and that we shouldn't be able to judge it. Like, maybe it's quality, but not necessarily, like, you know what I'm saying? I don't know.
You said we were looking eye to eye, and we are like looking eye to eye, and that's all
fear,
I can think of.
I have a fear that
your beautiful eyes.
I have a fear that entertainment is just going to become homogenized and like the same thing, because of people being afraid to kind of say what you just said. That, and that is an example of a type of thing.
This group think that is spreading, like Reddit is like the big, the big information age. And that's sort of like, they call it like the circle jerk of like people just shoot the same information to the top.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are some good aspects in that people are getting information they never had the access to. I know you've talked about the information age to me a lot. Mm-hmm. But there's also some bad aspects in that people from different regions and different parenthoods used to believe very different things.
Mm.
And now everyone's sort of getting their information from similar places.
Yeah. And but also putting their own unique information out there for people who have maybe different information to see. And then they put their information out there and it doesn't mesh. And it's like kind of, that's why niche exists more now, because it's allowed people to identify like, oh, these are the people who like this one thing. And like, I'll go over there with them and stay over there and exist there and not need to talk to this other thing or exist with this other thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like recently graduated kids who are insecure about their lives. I just want to hear people they may or may not know talk.
Yeah. Well, speaking of graduating, so what other takeaway from college did you have, besides like maybe having a more realized full understanding of what you just expressed?
Well, I was very philosophy focused in college. I also played football for a year.
Mm-hmm.
Then I quit because a guy I was a big fan of, Junior Seau, committed suicide, and they said it was due to concussions.
Wow, that's
and,
the reason you quit.
And I had a concussion my freshman year, and I was just sort of going over the pros and cons, and I decided that it wasn't worth it.
Can you tell me about the thing you told me about what you did for the concussion test in high school?
Oh yeah, this is not something I'm very proud of, but I was
you were very dedicated to
tough kid growing up, more so than I am now. I grew up in a hockey household, and there's this actual story that I was playing street hockey, and my dad fell on top of me and crushed me, and I couldn't lift my arm. When I hit, his body hit me, I hit the pavement, bam, I was a seven-year-old kid.
Yeah.
And we were playing a big street hockey game, and I couldn't lift my arm, and I said, I'm fine, I can go in. And one of the dads who was playing with us happened to be like a bone surgeon or whatever they call it. And my mom was like crying, super overprotective mother. He's hurt. He broke his bone. And the doctor said he couldn't have broke his bone or he'd be crying.
Right.
And then the next day I went in for an x-ray and I had a broken collarbone.
Wow. So you're a tough little motherfucker.
Yeah. So, when I played football, football was like my life. I lived in Texas. I always loved the camaraderie and everything about football. And
that's fucking religion down there is football.
Yeah. I even actually was a volunteer student assistant coach my senior year because I wanted to like give back a little bit. And I was thinking that maybe despite me not wanting to play, I could coach, but then it conflicted morally sometimes, and it was also just like a shitty job,
like teaching other kids how to do this thing that you don't want to do yourself.
Yeah, despite me loving football.
Yeah. You still watch?
Yeah, I watch it like a diehard.
Huh.
So what was I? Oh, so when I was
in high school,
we took this thing called the baseline test, which was
anyone who played football recently knows about that in high school.
Yeah, and the baseline test was like almost like an IQ, like logic sort of test that you took on the computer, and then you got a score. And then if you had concussion-like symptoms, you could not return, like, if your test was significantly lower than that first test, then you were in the protocol, and then you would have to wait till your test became that score. And then, like, a week later.
Mm.
So if you were below the baseline, you could be out, like, 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that happened to some kids in our high school, and, like, we knew about that. So I purposely scored really low on the baseline test, like, got many answers wrong. So in case I got a concussion, I could take the test, which I never had to retake it in high school. I would pass with flying colors.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I don't recommend kids doing that, because when you're the same age as me, when we were freshmen,
you're a little older,
but we're the same grade,
same graduate.
When we were freshmen, I feel like concussions were not that big of a thing.
We were like right in the midst of it starting, kind of like.
Yeah, when I was a freshman, it was still called like getting your bell rung.
Yeah.
And then by the time I was a senior, it was like people were suing the NFL.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like everyone was decrepit coming on camera. And so we sort of went through this.
You got a fuzz on your face.
I am very sweaty, I think, from all this philosophy.
No, it's because I turned the air conditioning off because it makes a noise. But we're almost done. Maybe, unless we keep talking.
How long are we?
How long do you think we are?
Dude, I think I spoke about philosophy for 25 solid minutes. I feel like I spoke way too much because Joe is a great host.
How long do you think we're at?
I'd say 50 minutes.
We're at 52.
Wow. Look at me, guys. This is my first podcast. Evan Sandlin here on the Joe Cole Show. Bada bing, bing, bang, ching, ching, ching.
So, after you leave college, what is the, or as college is coming down to, you went all 4 years, you graduated.
Yeah.
As it's approaching its end, are you like ready to start the next phase? What were you emotionally feeling or preparing for after college? And what was the plan?
Well, I dated a girl my first 3 years of college. So senior year was more my year to myself.
Mm-hmm.
So the first half was me trying to...
fuck girls.
Yes, of course. I was in a fraternity.
Yeah.
But the first half was me trying to be a football coach.
Mm.
And then I didn't like that. So then the second half, I was watching this show we spoke about briefly called The Larry Sanders Show.
Mm-hmm.
And, what's his name? Jeremy Piven, mm-hmm. who is
He's a guest
the
star.
Reason I actually watched the show was I was so into Entourage at the time.
Really?
That I was reading all the things he was in. And I was like, hey, I want to check this one out. It's about comedians.
That's how you found out about Larry Sanders. Huh?
And so I watched through Jeremy Piven. So I watched the Larry Sanders Show, and Jeremy
Maybe the
Piven
best show of all time.
Had it? No, I don't think so. But a very honest show, yeah. Similar to what this is.
Maybe and, the best com, one of the best comedy shows of all time.
And well, Jeffrey Tambor is
oh my god,
so funny,
so good.
Hey now,
it's so real,
so great.
There's a part at the end where. Sorry, you're sweating. Should I turn the fan on?
Well,
no. There's a part at the end where
it's okay.
He's like, what are you talking about? He's writing a book. He's going to be writing a book about his life. Like, it ends badly with him.
Oh, I didn't make it through
show.
No.
He, like, it doesn't end well. And he's like, I'm writing a book about my life. And you're not going to be in it. And you won't be in it. And he, like, freaks out. I've heard Judd Apatow say that the show is about, I think I said this to you yesterday, is about people who love each other, but show business gets in the way.
That is what you said.
Yes. Yeah.
That's
and I like that a lot.
Judd Apatow putting things so finely tuned.
Yeah.
You dog.
So then what happened with seeing the Larry Sanders Show?
So Jeremy Piven had this role as a comedy writer on the show.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really? As a writer?
As a writer. And there was like a writer's room. And I had never thought of that. I loved comedy growing up. I think some of my fondest memories, besides like sports and friends, were like me and my father watching Austin Powers together.
Mm-hmm.
I loved those movies and Rush Hours. Mm-hmm. And so it
Rush
got me
Hours
thinking,
really? I love Rush Hour. That's me and my one of my me and my brother's favorite movies. We quote it all the time.
Yeah, love Rush Hour.
Oh my god, Chris Tucker.
Damn, that guy ain't going to be in Rush Hour 3.
Oh, it's the greatest.
That's my favorite one.
It's not even in the movie. No, it's in the outtakes.
So,
I saw Rush Hour 3 in theaters. You talked about the second, like, preparing for being out of college, and then for some reason you brought up second semester where you got into Larry Sanders Show.
Oh. I've noticed this in interviews. You ask me questions, and then I answer something else before I answer the question.
I do that with other people? Or
no,
you?
I do that.
Oh.
I'm, like, self-analyzing
it's
myself
okay.
through.
It's quite all right. Do you, so, baby.
Do me.
So, second semester, Larry Sanders Show. Why?
Jeremy Piven was a comedian.
Oh, so did you, is this
was
about?
Was a comedy writer, and yeah. I thought to myself, this is like the job.
Right.
This is, how can I do this? So I started Googling it, and then I read like 7 or 8 books
right.
in college about how to be a stand-up comedian, how to write movies, how
right.
to write sketches. Just like couldn't get enough content to read. And the biggest, thing I took from it, especially for stand-up,
mm-hmm.
is to write down every like thought you have,
mm-hmm.
especially if it's funny. So I have this notepad that you can see that like I wrote. this was like my notes for, I brought notes for my philosophy thing because it was too grand for me to say off the top of my head.
Yeah.
I take notes of every funny thing I ever see. And I have like, I have like 150
dude, this
pages.
Is a lot of thoughts.
Yeah, but some of them.
Those are a lot of jokes.
Dude, some of them go on for
That's
like.
That's crazy.
So I write like, I'm like a very.
You're a big writer.
I write a lot. So.
Say one thing that you have written down in there. Just like, what's one thing you have written down?
Well, here's a joke because we were talking about concussions.
Right.
Do you remember the NFL like sent out a survey to players asking if anyone remembered getting a concussion?
Yeah.
No one remembered.
So you just have like random jokes.
So yeah, and a lot of them are shit or just like ideas and
yeah.
I never know. Like people give me premises all the time
mm-hmm.
and I'm like, listen, I have enough premises that
yeah.
are unique to me.
Yeah.
It's how to get from that premise to the funny.
Yeah.
Which is like such a struggle.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I.
So some punchlines take years.
So I've become a stand-up, or you could, I'm really a waiter, guys. I do stand-up on the side.
How many times have you done stand-up since graduating college?
12 times, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done one paid show, and I'm doing another paid show on the 27th, Saturday, at Point Break. This is my plug. It's in Manhattan by Bryant Park.
Yeah.
And so that should be a good show. I'm doing 8 minutes.
How did you get in a type of situation where you can get paid to do stand-up?
It's probably just like luck. I did a few open mics, hated them. Even though after the first few, I started doing well at the open mics.
Why do you hate them?
They're very depressing. Right. I don't like to see people do poorly, and a lot of people do. And like, I struggle with my stage presence. And
it's scary being out there by yourself.
It is. It is the hardest thing I've ever done.
Yeah,
by far. And so I wanted to do a show, and I met this guy, Jeff. I think his name's Jeff Lawrence, and he organizes shows at this place called The Stand, and you can have bringer shows, where you bring five people, and you do a set for 5 minutes in front of a live audience, and then if you pay $20, they give you a videotape. So I have videotapes of me doing early stand-up, and one particular set, I told some very, very raunchy stuff that I don't even believe in, but the stuff I believe in and the stuff I find funny are like many times
like
different.
Like you said, it's your perception of reality. It's not an actual, it's not, you know,
yeah, I've said not, it's not me. Yeah. So
it's an extension of you.
It is an extension. It's an extension of I've always loved stupid comedy. So while there's like this strive for realness and for thought, how much of it is what do you enjoy? And like, I enjoy like slapstick. So I told a lot of these slapstick jokes and the place was rolling in laughter.
What's one joke?
The dirtiest joke, and this was the first great joke I wrote. No, there's dirtier ones than that. But it was when I turned 19, I got my first fake ID. It said that I was 16, so I could still fuck minors.
Did you tell the underwear joke?
No, no. That was a more recent joke I wrote very recently.
Oh, are you going to use that for the...
Yeah, I'm going to open that.
Let's not spoil that joke.
So I thought that was like a great joke, great misdirection of me getting a fake ID. But obviously the final message is very convoluted.
About what your intentions actually are.
Exactly. But I think most people understood I was kidding. And this guy, Eric,
joke.
Saw my set and he loved it. And we hooked up. We didn't make out. we exchanged phone numbers.
Yeah.
And then he has since like gone bar to bar, like asking to do comedy shows where he hosts and comedians go on. And so since then, he has put me on one show, and this is going to be the second. And I guess, like, he got enough people. He does a pretty big mailing list that he actually paid me for the spot.
Wow.
Which was awesome, but at the same point, he's sort of my only in right now, so I don't really consider myself a working comic.
Yeah. Well, you got to just keep doing it.
Yeah. Which is trouble for me. I'm more of a writer.
Yeah.
But I, you know, why I do UCB and the stand-up is to meet writers and to get involved in the community.
What have you liked about UCB the most?
UCB, like, this actually feels very natural to me. Like, I was very scared to go on this podcast beforehand, but I feel
why
good with this.
Is?
I like bouncing. I love the creativeness. I think I talked to you about this yesterday about football. I love camaraderie. And stand-up is very lonely and
individualistic.
Yeah, I like, despite, I've actually spoke for, I think, the majority of this podcast, but I like back and forth.
But you're speaking to me.
Yeah, and you're talking, and like it's helping me think of new thoughts. And like, I don't like the idea of like, trying to remember what I like memorized and like bouncing and being like, that wasn't a good segue. Should I do the whole set for memorization? Should I just talk? Like what is the way to do it? In improv, it's kind of just like go with the flow. And for someone who prided themselves on like being funny in the moment in school, like to me, that is more fun. but there's less career potential.
Mm-hmm. I also like it because it's the first time where recently where I'm not like super self-conscious. Like it's I kind of get out of my own head in a way.
Were you in 101?
What?
Were you self-conscious in 101?
I'm self-conscious in that I still think like, should I do that? Like, would that be funny? Or would I look like an idiot? But I'm not like, I'm thinking about the scene. I'm not really thinking about me. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of
how can I help the scene?
I'm not thinking. It's the first time where I'm like not, I'm a 0% self-serving. I'm not like selfish. Even though I am, because there's times probably where I could do something to maybe take a bigger risk, a bigger sacrifice, and make myself look like an idiot and just, but like, that's also me being afraid that it actually won't help the scene. I'm not just worried about myself.
So you weren't nervous in 101?
I was.
Because I was definitely nervous.
I was. But I'm saying like, now I become like a little less self-conscious. Like, it helps me clear my head. It's very therapeutic, I feel.
Same. But after each scene, do you like go, I could have done this
better? Yeah.
Yeah. That's the thing about improv is there's more self-doubt.
Yeah.
Because it's in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So you always afterward, you have so many great ideas.
Yeah.
So you can't do it perfectly in the moment.
Yeah.
It's very rare.
I like that. It'll never be perfect, though.
Yeah. You got to just sort of understand that and be okay with your flaws
and
your imperfections.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like that it's one of the most honest and in the moment, off the cuff kind of expressions of that mirroring of reality. Of what we perceive in that moment to be what is real or like what is important to say, even though like at our level we're not doing that much important things or saying that much with our performances, but I like that aspect of it too.
So what's your sort of like goal in comedy?
That's the thing I was going to say to you is you had a very realized focused comedy, whereas I came out of college and was thinking just acting in general and performing in general.
Okay, so the podcast
was, I'm not doing anything and I have an itch. I've talked about this before. I need to do something creative. And I got, because I had so little to do, I got into podcasts like crazy. And I was like.
So would you say it's focused towards comedy or just towards people our age?
I mean, I don't have really, the focus is just everything I've said. I mean, I like to try to be funny and I like comedy. So like I try to not make it super serious and have some type of like humor that goes along with it, but I don't think it's a comedy podcast necessarily.
Did you tell the story of the first time you did an open mic?
Oh, I think I have.
I love that story.
I went to the Stress Factory in New Brunswick, and I told some, I had like 5 minutes prepared, and I told my first joke, which was this like double entendre joke about.
Ha!
That was the response I got. I told the double entendre joke, and there was a silence for a second, then I just hear, ha! Just like one guy do that out of like the 10 who were in the room. And then I got nervous that I didn't create a laugh by that. So it made me forget the next joke I had. And I was like, oh, that's all I got. And I walked off the stage.
It's funny that that's similar to my first time.
Yeah, what happened?
I went to an open mic with my older brother.
Yeah.
And we waited for a while. And I kept like going over in my head my 5 minutes. It was actually pretty tight.
Mm-hmm.
Five. Like it's mostly, you know.
One-liners.
So I feel like for a new comic, it's easier. Although my delivery was awful.
Mm-hmm.
And like my stage presence, I was walking back and forth. It's easier for a young comic, if they're a good writer, to be a one-liner. Mm-hmm. Than like a storyteller.
Less personality kind of needs to come through.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I told, well, first off, the host was wearing all pink and he had long hair and a beard. So my first joke was, and this was like a joke I was real proud of for a while. It's not a great joke, but I always wanted to start with like a joke that was like, thank you all for coming or like whatever, like a phrase that people said at the beginning.
Right.
So my first joke was supposed to be, give a hand to handless amputees. So, but this guy was wearing all pink, so I decided to say, can we all give a hand to gay Jesus for being a great host?
Yeah.
And then he flashed me his light on his phone to say that you have like 1 minute, just as like a joke.
Yeah.
To be like, don't call me out.
Yeah.
And then I went, give a hand to handless amputees. Yeah. And nobody laughed.
Oh,
no.
Even though it shows when I've opened with it, it's done
yeah, but
well.
Just like maybe but it just trying to make it not the opener. Like,
and then I told one more joke that I'm not going to tell,
yeah.
And it got a lot of laughs because it's very dirty. And then I didn't remember anything else, and I walked off the stage.
And that's all that happened?
Yep, that was my whole first time. So it was similar in that I was up there for maybe 35 seconds.
Yeah.
And like...
So scary.
So scary.
Well, so we usually end for hopes for the future. Evan?
Nice segue. What does that mean?
It means your hopes, professional, personal, long-term, short-term.
You know, I...
See, you know, the funny thing is, I've never even said this, I always talk about... We always end with hopes for the future, but a thing I talk about all the time is just being in the moment and not worrying about anything other than what's happening right now. Obviously, no one who ever was successful completely lived by that, and there has to be some preparation for what's to come. But, like, I don't know. What are your thoughts on, like, making 5-year plans? Are you a person who gets ahead of yourself?
Well, I think right now I'm in a place where when I graduated, I said, I have until I turn 25 to do something in comedy, or I'm going to go to law school.
Mm.
And I don't know if I'm still going to stand by that, but I do feel the pressure of that's 14 months away.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the future, I love to try new things. Mm-hmm. I love to hear people's opinions. That's why I love philosophy. I love like people who think differently than me and like understanding why, which I think you sort of broke down with me today.
Mm-hmm.
So, just keep trying new things.
Mm-hmm.
Try and find happiness in your day.
Mm.
Some bullshit like that.
Well, thanks, man. I appreciate you doing this.
Dude, thank you for having me. This was like a fun time.
It's been fun. We're going to see Sausage Party tonight.
Sausage Party. Seth Rogen, one of my favorite writers. Do you know he started on Borat, on the Ali G show?
That was the first writing gig he got at like age 18 or like 19. Maybe it was 21. He was 21.
That changed my life. That show and then Borat.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really did.
Ridiculous. Really. Seth Rogen, a thing he talks about in interviews a lot was his contribution was... He told all of them what spring break was. And like they didn't, like all, because they're from England, they didn't understand what the concept of spring break is. Like, what is spring break? They didn't understand that had like a geographical, like you go to spring break in like Florida. But
it's just raining no matter what. Yeah. They didn't go on holiday, they call it, to Ibiza. Do some crazy ass shit. He probably did. He's a crazy guy.
Do you want to get dinner too?
What are you thinking? Where do you, like, what pizzeria do you work at?
Let's not talk about that.
Okay, I'm sorry.
All right, well, let's go see Sausage
Party. Let's go get dinner.
All right, that's it. Thank you for listening. Thank you to Evan. I hope everyone enjoyed that conversation as much as I did having it. Something that I realized listening back to the conversation about the parallels between how Evan used comedy and philosophy to understand and emotionally accept some of the absurdity of life. It's funny because from a philosophical standpoint, Evan talked about using something called theistic proofs, which is, I guess, kind of like a spiritual formula for getting a better understanding of everything. And Jerry Seinfeld has said that comedy is like proofs as well. He said in his Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee episode with Jimmy Fallon that because in comedy you say something interesting or ridiculous in the premise and then the punchline kind of proves it to be true, or at least if the joke is working, you know, it resonates truthfully in some way, which then hopefully helps you have a better understanding of the interesting or ridiculous thing. Also, I want to say that a lot of the ideas I said about the possibility of groupthink potentially causing entertainment to become, you know, the same thing, a lot of those ideas were inspired from a conversation Pete Holmes and Mike Birbiglia had on a recent episode of the You Made It Weird podcast, and I paraphrased a lot of what I heard them talk about, but I just wanted to say that. And one final thing,
I actually have Mustafa Eligar here, who is back in New Jersey for a week after moving to Baltimore, and I wanted him to kind of amend or offer more insight into what I talked about with Evan when I said something that Mustafa told me that I butchered in the conversation about an atypical understanding of God, which he learned from a philosophy podcast called Philosophize This, and I just wanted him to come on and clarify.
So, you like just understand what you were saying.
Right.
You were saying basically...
I was saying basically that like there's like kind of like a not understandable like force that kind of controls everything and keeps everything moving has always caused everything to happen, and that's God. Not necessarily that he chooses what to happen, what not to happen. He has like a very
more of a passive, like,
yeah, more of
over...
a, like a thing that controls everything. So I guess it's a little too. The reason I butchered explaining it is because I think it was too lofty, and we didn't talk about it enough for me to have a full kind of understanding of it.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm a little rusty on all this. So,
yeah, I literally just asked you to come on.
Yeah, and I wish I'd like spent more time. But to your point, that's definitely like a school of thought that, I mean, it's that has the stereotype of like the hippie type of thinking, like God is one, God is all of us.
Mm.
But it's like kind of, it's more of a actual, if you think about it, it's more of a humbling outlook on what God is rather than God being this being that is only there to pay attention to what humans are doing.
Mm.
You know, sins and good sins, bad sins and all that good stuff. So to have God to be this, not even omnipotent, but this thing. Here's the thing also. So just I'm going to go
not
ahead and
not all controlling, not all knowing necessarily.
It starts here. That's the issue because someone like Hegel, which is a very famous philosopher, I think Karl's name is, doesn't matter. He dismissed the conventional idea of God, which is, like a being, like a infinite, like a omnipotent being.
Mm-hmm.
But that in itself is a flawed idea from his perspective, and it goes to what you're saying, because if God is truly infinite, then God cannot be a being, because a being that is one being among others is already limited by its relations to others. So what I mean is like being, let's say a dog, means that you're not a human, means that you're not a cat, means that you're not a turkey, means that you're not grass, you're not a car, you're a dog.
Mm-hmm.
So by identifying something like a dog is already limiting its existence based on the things around it, like how it's relative to other things. Like I know that's a dog because a dog has a nose, a snout, a hair like a dog, you know, all that stuff that makes a dog a dog.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a dog.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm using those characterizations in relation to how I characterize everything else in the world.
Mm.
That's how I can separate a dog from a turkey and a cat. I'm saying its nose is a little longer than a cat. That's how it's a dog, not a cat.
Right, right, right.
So by limiting God, by saying God is an omnipotent being, it's saying that God is not a human. God is not a dog. God is not grass. God is not, et cetera. So to think of God as a being is to render God finite.
Mm-hmm.
So that whole argument goes to what your buddy was saying in the podcast and yourself was that, you know, you get to backtrack and backtrack and backtrack, and eventually you're like, that cause and effect, where'd that cause start? Like the Big Bang Theory, he was saying, like, that was an effect of something prior.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then where's the first thing that happened?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And a lot of philosophers prove this to be the existence of why God is real, but not the God, the conventional monotheistic God that's, you know, between Islam, Christianity, Judaism, etc. There, the outlook is, for us to exist right now, there had to be something that created us, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, that is already limited by our flaws and our inability to understand. Well, not inability, I don't mean to sound pretentious. What
ignorance.
I mean, and it's not even ignorance, it's just our incapability to possibly understand something that's way beyond our understanding.
Mm.
Because, you know, like we we are very attuned to using this cause and effect concept to explain a lot of things. Mm-hmm. We live by the cause and effect because for us, it doesn't make sense to something that's not following the cause and effect rule doesn't make sense. There mm-hmm. has to be a cause to any effect. Mm-hmm. In order for that car to be seen in your driveway, Ben had to drive in here. Mm. In order for that car to even exist, someone had to make it. In order for someone to make it, someone had to ship raw parts. In order for those raw parts to have been made, it needed to come from the ground. Mm-hmm. In order for the ground to have this, it needed that, and then et cetera. Mm-hmm. But the flaw in that is, or I guess the support in where God exists is, if God created it, what created God? Exactly. But then Hegel's perception on God solves that, and that nothing created God because God is infinite. Mm-hmm. And now we're starting to approach something that's going against the grain of our own ability to think. Mm-hmm. Because when I say that God is infinite, then it's almost still compelling to be like, well, then what created God? Mm-hmm. But for us to question that proves our fundamental understanding of possibly how something much greater than us works. Does that make sense?
Fundamental misunderstanding. Or
yes. Basically, it's like what I'm saying is, you know, God isn't an omnipotent being in some philosopher's, you know, theology, I guess. He is, or to even call it, he is restricting it again.
It's kind of everything.
See, that's the thing. Yeah, like God, it's so easy to be like, he is, or God is, as in whenever we say that.
It's not even identifiable, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. And it sounds so hippie, like, you know, I'm sure someone who's very religious would be like, this sounds like a bunch of jargon, but it really is, jargon?
Jargon is just words, isn't it? Isn't that what that means?
Yeah.
Okay.
But really, I think it's, I mean, whether you believe it or not, and I don't even know what the hell I believe, but I think it's a very humbling perspective of what God is. It's this thing that we don't understand, that we might believe is infinite, and to even say that is something beyond our understanding. And that's okay, because we only know what we experience, and our experiences limit our understanding of something that could be infinite, something that is truly omnipotent, something that's truly, it's almost like a more exciting way to think about God, instead of a God being like he who watches over us and is personified through our like almost selfish bearings of having to portray ourselves and everything that we try to understand. And I don't know how that relates to anything you were saying with your buddy, but
I guess it does. This is a oneness kind of, it's like an unexplainable, just the way it's not one thing. Mm-hmm. But it's everything, and it kind of just makes everything happen, but it's not.
Yeah, see, and I wish I could
identify.
There's definitely another school of thought that goes into that more.
Yeah.
But they're very related in that they're all pretty much saying stop calling God God, like stop calling God like this thing.
Yeah, Pete God Holmes talks about it a lot. It's just like this. It's kind of like an unexplainable force between everything and everyone that...
Yeah, like a common denominator almost. Yeah, and that's I think that's like rooted by Buddhism, and I wish I could speak to it more. And it was definitely in that podcast. I just don't remember. Like, I'd rather say that I don't know.
I guess the message of this is don't get caught in your initial and perception of something that easily... what's kind of fed to you, the common notion of what a thing is, and continue to try to understand or learn more and educate yourself more on
type
of thinking that maybe isn't universal.
Definitely. And I think the coolest thing about that thought,
and we need to keep educating ourselves more, obviously.
Absolutely.
That's why I was saying that.
Yes. It's a humbling.
Everyone's probably like, why? These guys don't know what the fuck they're talking about.
No, it's okay to admit that, like, you know, our understanding is limited. I think it's the most honest. I think again, going back to what I was saying, I think the coolest thing was talking about how, like, God is not a being because being a being makes you dependent on things.
It limits God.
It limits God to a finite thing, because if you are one thing, then you're not something else. Mm-hmm. And by not being something else, your very existence is dependent on that antonym, that mm-hmm. thing that's not you, mm-hmm. that dog. So you can identify yourself as a human. Mm-hmm. So by being a being limits you finitely. Mm-hmm. And I think that in itself, think about that mm-hmm. and see where you go with that. And if that's something that holds on to you, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm starting to lose my voice.
Fading off. All right. Well, thanks, Dov. Thank you for coming on to talk about that. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah. I hope that made any sense.
Yeah.
And it probably didn't.
It's okay.
If not, whatever, man.
Yeah. Thanks to everyone who's listened. Good luck with your week in Jersey and good luck with going back to Baltimore. I already said thank you to everyone who listened. I'll talk to you guys next week. I have another episode with another classmate of mine from UCB. So talk to you in a week.
And it's long and farewell.
Yeah. And when I say talk to you for a week, I always say, but I'm not, I'm just talking to you. You're not talking to me. I don't even know who you are out there, but I hope you're there.
Maybe it's God.
Mm-hmm.